which didn't take long before it was noticed. And he progressed very, very rapidly up the hierarchy of the telephone company. And when we were up there, he was the general manager of the whole telephone area. He'd done so very, very well. And it was a thrill for me as captain of Quebec to be able to talk with Sam there. And of course, I attributed very much my progress to the things that he taught me and the principles that he stood for when I was a youngster. Well, that's about all for now. After Cornwallis, I went to Quebec. I enjoyed Quebec. And after 18 months or almost 2 years in her, I left her, and I was terribly disappointed to be sent as to commanding officer of naval divisions as chief of staff. The con was Ken Adams at the time, but actually I enjoyed the job. It gave me a chance to travel to parts of Canada that I'd not been before, and I did my best to shake him up. You remember, you were there at the time, and I had some interesting trips. But oddly enough, I was only there a very, very short while, 9 months as a matter of fact, one of the shortest appointments. Well, it was the shortest appointment I'd ever had. And then I was told that I was going to relieve Kenny Dyer as Combrax at Maiden. And I went there in about 48, I think it was, I'm not quite sure. And of course, it was a delight to be at the West Coast again with that magnificent house at the point there. And I enjoyed that. From there, Kenny Dyer went up as deputy chief of personnel. And after I'd been there at Maiden for about three and a half, I think, about that, Kenny phoned me and said, would I consider a move to Halifax? I said, oh, sure. I said, I don't want to leave the Navy. I was approaching my retirement age. And he said, well, how about chief of staff to Hugh Pullen? Well, I'd served with Hugh when he was flag officer Pacific Coast and took over from him for three or four months when he had a heart attack. And we'd known each other well, and I had great respect for him. And so I went to Halifax as chief of staff, and I stayed there not quite a couple of years, and then went up to Ottawa to relieve Kenny Dyer as deputy CNP to Kenny Dyer. And I must say, this was my first job in Ottawa, and I didn't know how Ottawa worked, and I spent all my time asking questions. And I found it very, very difficult. It took me a long, long time to understand. In fact, I never really did get used to it. And after 6 months or so, I didn't realize it, but old Kenny was sort of breaking me in for CNP. And at the end of that time, I was taken before Harry DeWolf and promoted to Rear Admiral. I was fortunate enough to have Ralph Hennessy as my deputy, and he, of course, being the capable guy that he was, carried a great deal of the burden. He knew Ottawa inside and out, and I had an excellent staff.
I've just remembered another incident of Cappy Musgrave. It was whilst in Cornwallis. We'd had a snowfall, not really too severe, and there were about half a dozen officers that didn't get in for the divisions in the morning to start the day's work. A couple of young sub-lieutenants who were new entry training, even the dental officer, schoolie, and a supply of all sorts of conditions, and mainly as a lesson to these young executive types who I felt they should put their ship and establishment first. I because it wasn't as severe. If they'd really tried to get in, they could have done. And so I sent for them, and I said, I should require you to stay on board. I said, you send for shaming gear. You behave like an ordinary seaman would get punished for this. And I said, I want you to realize that your duty to your ship or establishment comes first. And so I subsequently reported this to Captain Musgrave, and he nodded agreement. But just after quarters, I went in to have a chat with him after evening quarters, and he said, Commander, he said, you just phone Mrs. Budge, and when you go, he said, go home and tell Mrs. Budge that you'll be required for duty tonight. He said, let you and I go over the wardroom and stop Ali. We'll join them. And so, sure enough, I went home and said, well, I shan't be in for supper tonight, Myrtle. And so I joined the captain, and we went over to the wardroom, and there they were, these half a dozen, eight of them, I think they were, disconsolate, scowling at each other, pretty shock a bunch. So old Cappy went over there and had the bar open, which was about the only time he really infringed on. And he did say to me, well, let's do this. And so eventually with his cheerful attitude, he soon cheered about. We had quite a pleasant evening. And I think he not only did himself good, because they had great respect for him, but he also did them a lot of good. He made them realize that you have to do your job, and you can do it cheerfully. Well, I think that's about all, Hal. From Cornwallis, I went to Quebec and so on. I've told you all that, and after Quebec, I went to... And again, I think I've told you that. But after I retired in about 63, and I went and worked for a couple of years for the Navy League of Canada, working in their headquarters in Toronto. But either I didn't understand what they wanted of me, or they didn't understand what I wanted of them, or what. But at the end of 2 years, I resigned, and... it really, with the exception of working in the field with these youngsters, it was a job that did not appeal to me. I was no accountant or a collector of revenue, or to collect money for the organization, and so I retired. Well, that's about all, Hal. I wish I'd been able to spend another delightful afternoon in your cubby hole, which I liked very much, and I like to spend a few hours in there just browsing around, looking at your books and pictures. As I say, I would have enjoyed another afternoon with you, but go and have everything all your own way. So I'll say goodbye, many grateful thanks. If in due course you will return that book and the and the paper of mine by mail, no rush about it. And I think if you go on with this tape, you'll find some medical conversation, because these tapes were used previously by my son-in-law, who is a pediatrician, and he frequently records lectures he's listened to, or lectures he's given, or even the daily comments on his patients, which he turns over to a stenographer to put down for the record. So, well, thank you very much, Hal, and goodbye.
Dr. Mattson.
Well, that's been my experience, too, that in the most recent study of 11, 7 of our 11 had gastrointestinal side effects, most of whom vomited, and maybe a third of our first group of 23. I agree that taking it with the meals helps some, but it doesn't always solve it, because often the vomiting comes on perhaps an hour later, and I think that's the peak blood level, so I believe it's probably also central, although I'm not certain yet.
Dr. Cutt.
I agree with Dr. Madsen, because we have also seen two types of nausea, one that comes very soon after the swallow and then subsides. The other is that comes sort of an hour or so later, and that is the harder one to deal with. The early nausea can be easily modified by the meal. And I think that the syrup seems to cause more immediate nausea than the capsules do, probably because it hits the stomach wall immediately. A capsule takes time to dissolve, and maybe it's slower.
We asked about sedation, and the discussion rapidly shifted to the interaction of Depakine with phenobarbital. Here's Dr. Adams.
I've not had too much of a problem with sedation. I think that's a very minor point in my experience. I'm perhaps one or two out of 60 that thought they were more tired, but I can't really say it's been a problem.
Dr. Rothner.
Again, I think we have to divide this into two groups. I think in the drug-naive patients, it's rather uncommon. In the patient on multiple medications, especially with barbiturates, we've had a hospitalize one and take care of the other over the phone, who on barbiturates had dramatic increases in barbiturate level.
I have two drug-naive patients that are on it and are controlled, and their doses are low, so that when you're dividing, you're going to have to divide by dose per kilo or blood level also.
Let's don't divide, but I think we can unequivocally say that if the patient's on phenobarbital and on a therapeutic level of phenobarbital, if you don't recognize the fact, you're going to have problems. Because I have, in fact, before I came up to this meeting, I looked at the blood levels on all the patients who were taking phenobarb when they started Valparate, and every one of them had significant increases in phenobarbital levels, and doses had to be reduced in one patient, for example, from 200 milligrams of phenobarbital a day to 60 milligrams of phenobarbital a day to maintain the same level. Yeah. And fortunately, I had no patients go to sleep and not wake up, but then we were monitoring blood levels within 12 hours after we saw the patient. We knew what the blood level was, and we picked up a telephone call and said, cut the phenobarb back. But unequivocally, there should be a red mark around drug interaction in relationship to phenobarbital, because one of the bad things that can happen to this drug is have half the kids that who are already on phenobarbital start taking it and all go to sleep.
Monitoring blood levels, of course we all monitor blood levels. The first dose of the real medicine that I gave this kid on a Monday, he didn't wake up Tuesday morning. So I didn't have his blood, he wasn't scheduled to come back.
I understand what you're saying. I just say that we need to red flag this drug interaction.
The physician has got to know that if the patient is on barbiturates, especially, that with the first dose of medication, the patient has got to be told that if excessive lethargy occurs, the dose, you've got to consult your physician.
It's a little hard for me to understand how after one dose of valproic acid you can elevate phenobarbital fast enough to do this. And I think that while I wouldn't quarrel that there's an interaction, I believe that the drug has a direct hypnotic sedative effect independent of any interaction. And we have documented this in many people. One fellow who finally had to be removed from our first study would become dysarthric, somnolent, and his electroencephalographic background would drop 2 to 3 hertz. We repeated this on 3 occasions. All of his other anti-epileptic drug levels remained unaltered during this time. There was no doubt but that the effect was strictly, or I can't say strictly, because he was on other medicines, so it may be additive, but the key variable was the valproic acid. So it does have an independent hypnotic effect, and I don't think it's serious, and I think that goes, and it is to some extent dose-related, but it does exist, and people simply have to be aware of it, that's all.
Dr. Cutt.
We haven't had any naive patients, so I can't say about the direct effect in naive patients. But when we have seen sedation, that's usually been parallel to the rise of the barbiturate level. I must say that we usually go up with the Depakin dose very slowly, so it maybe counts for us not seeing much sedative effect attributable to Depakin as such.
One of the most elusive questions about Depakin has been the range of values for therapeutic blood levels. Data on this question are still in the process of being gathered. In the meantime, this portion of the discussion may give you some background in the difficulties inherent in gathering such data. Here is Dr. Rothner.
If one looks at the patients in the reviews that were well controlled and those that had no control or even worsening of their seizures, the blood level ranges were exactly the same. So it's the patient's seizures that are the determining factor, not necessarily a blood level, and I don't see any beautiful relationship.
Dr. Cutt.
I agree that there is tremendous individual variation in the effective dose and level.
Dr. Mattson.
Simply to follow that a little bit further, I'm not sure I agree entirely, whereas the seizure type is probably the most important variable as to the responsiveness rather than the dose and the blood level. On the other hand, there is some variability in the blood levels for a given dose, and in fact it can be quite considerable. Some patients have half the blood level with the same dose as someone else the same weight, and I think the responsiveness also may to some extent parallel the dose. So I don't think one can disregard the blood level entirely, because while it is more the seizure type that's crucial, I think the quantity of medicine at the brain level is still significant.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn your cassette over.